Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese. I thought for a second that I was going to open with some gag about how we should use our like Tallahassee names, but Oakland.
Let's go back to the beginning. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Grand Blank.
I'm Oakland. It's not very funny in execution, actually, but oh well, I can live with that.
We are the Shock Doctors, and as you may have guessed from our intro, the film we're going to be discussing today is Zombieland Double Tap. In our outro on the last episode, we said we were going to be watching Parasite, but the vicissitudes of living in the Midwest where art films come
How
late, if not
dare
at all.
How dare you plunder the name of my in-progress autobiography.
The vicissitudes of the Midwest.
Yeah.
So, we're not able to watch Parasite yet, but, you know, Zombieland Double Tap is a capable enough fill-in.
Yeah, it'll tide us over, like a midday snack, something nice and light.
So, for those of you who are not familiar with Zombieland, haven't seen it, which included Matt up until last night, Basically it follows a group of four people who all identify themselves by their hometowns, who sort of band together to make it through the zombie apocalypse, kind of a group of misfits. There's Jesse Eisenberg, who plays Columbus, and he plays a very Jesse Eisenberg character, sort of a nebbish. Woody Harrelson plays Tallahassee, who is just sort of a very colorful,
shit-kicking, gunslinging, good old boy.
Emma Stone plays Wichita, who is sort of a tough as nails, kind of difficult to get close to. Femme fatale isn't the right word per se, but she's tough. That's kind of her defining characteristic. And then her sister, played by Abigail Breslin, is Little Rock. I've always wondered, I guess maybe they were just born in different towns, their parents moved around a lot or something, but I did always kind of wonder why they had different names if they're sisters, given the nomenclature. So anyway, Zombieland, the original, came out in 2009, so this was kind of a long gestating sequel, which is becoming more and more the norm these days, I guess.
Yeah.
There was a failed TV pilot somewhere in the middle there, I believe. I don't remember who commissioned it, but yeah, did not pan out. And after long delays, all these actors, for one thing, were very busy. There's one of the trailers for this movie, which I found very amusing, identified them all as Academy Award nominees, and in Emma Stone's case, a winner, which, you know, kind of goes to show that, yeah, okay, these people have been very busy.
The last 10 years, yes. Covered a lot of ground.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's kind of the Zombieland primer, if you will. So, Matt, you want to take it away with the synopsis? The
movie opens with something of a zombie bestiary, I guess. It's narrated by Jesse Eisenberg, Columbus, although that's less of a defining characteristic of this movie than it was of the first one. It's not like wall-to-wall narration anymore.
Yeah, although it this opening narration about the different kinds of zombies is kind of this film's version of him doing the first few of his rules at the beginning of the first film.
Right.
In fact, this movie, at least at the beginning, kind of hits a lot of the same notes, I guess, just to help us get our bearings again after 10 years. There's that, and then the opening credits play over a super slow-mo montage of zombie killing set to a Metallica song.
Right.
This time it's Master of Puppets. I don't remember what the last one was, which is pretty bad because we watched it last night. But, yeah.
Yeah, the movie opens with a gag where Eisenberg says, "We know that you have a lot of choices when it comes to zombie entertainment, and we appreciate your continued patronage," or something like that. And I was sitting in the theater thinking, like, don't fucking remind me. I'm so fucking, the market is so saturated, and has been, and was in 2009. So, you know, it's only become, the deluge has kind of never stopped.
Well, yeah, since 2009, we've had, obviously, the entire fucking Walking Dead phenomenon, multiverse third series coming. Speaking of which, there is a gag relatively early on where Jesse Eisenberg is reading a Walking Dead comic and saying, "Wow, this is terrifying, but so unrealistic."
Yeah. Yeah, no, we've had like a zombie Twilight rom-com. We've had like a zombie Jane Austen. We've had a zombie musical.
Mm-hmm.
Zombies with Boy Scouts. I didn't see half of the movies that I just rattled off.
And when he did, I made him see them, so.
Yeah, true that. So we open with Jesse Eisenberg bringing us up to speed and talking about how they've spent the past 10 years just kind of bumming around the continental United States, sort of indexing different sub-breeds of zombies. I didn't write them down. There's the Homer, which are your kind of quintessential slow, stupid zombie.
Yeah, as in Simpson.
Yeah, and there's your Hawkings, as in Steven, who are smarter and a little more adept, a little more cunning.
And the Ninja, I believe, is the other one he lays out right at the beginning, which just kind of, as you would guess, sneaks up on you and kills you before you really know what's going on.
Yeah, the whole thing kind of gave me like Left 4 Dead vibes, you know, the way that you can...
A little bit, yeah.
The taxonomy aspect of it. I kind of wish that they'd gotten a little sillier with it, because the zombies in Left 4 Dead are a lot more diverse.
True.
So after the opening credits action scene set to Master of Puppets, they hole up in the White House for a little while.
It's For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That's the song in the first one. It
right.
just clicked. Sorry.
Yeah, I know. That's good, actually, because I think that when Master of Puppets started playing, I thought, like, all right, that's kind of a slightly obvious pick. And not just because they've done the Metallica thing before. I feel like, if anything, For Whom the Bell Tolls should have been in the sequel, because that's like a little bit more of a deep cut, but it kind of happened in reverse. In any case, Woody Harrelson anoints himself the president.
Yeah, because they've gone to Washington, D.C., and they've decided to shack up in the White House.
Yeah, they have a grand old time for a little while. They've formed a de facto family unit where Columbus and Wichita are sort of a bickering, soon-to-be-married couple. He tries to propose to her, and it doesn't go over very well. And Woody Harrelson, Tallahassee, is an overbearing dad to Little Rock. The first good hearty laugh in the movie, at least for me, was when they're doing Christmas in November, just because they can. You know, it's the civilization has collapsed. Woody Harrelson is done up like a mall Santa, and he gets Little Rock a gift, and he didn't have any wrapping paper, so it is wrapped in a portrait of Taft. Like a presidential portrait that has been ripped off the wall. You actually see it later with a big gouge missing from the middle. And he says, it's just Taft. We're actually one of our fattest presidents, so there's a lot left over if you know. So that was a good goof. And the gift in question is a gun that Elvis Presley gifted to Nixon. And the following day, partly because Little Rock can't take the Father Knows Best routine anymore, and partly because Emma Stone gets cold feet, the two sisters hit the road. They just bounce in the dead of night and leave behind a kind of perfunctory little note.
And they steal Woody Harrelson's car, which is another trope borrowed from the original.
Right.
They do it multiple times in the first film.
So Tallahassee and Columbus are sort of faffing about in an abandoned mall. Columbus is licking his wounds, and the two of them encounter a bumbling, ditzy sort of sorority girl character.
Very pink.
Yeah.
All in pink.
Named Madison, and she takes a shine to Columbus immediately because he's the first man that she's seen in, I guess, a decade. I mean, it's not clear to me if she's been living in the freezer in an abandoned mall, what, since 2009 or like day zero or whatever.
It's not immediately clear. Certainly put out there that it's been years, if not a decade,
right?
Necessarily.
And so
they shack up almost immediately.
Yeah, and Tallahassee hates her guts. That's another running gag in this movie, is that every new character that's introduced, Tallahassee just wants nothing to do with them. And I kind of felt the same way, actually. There was a lot of character audience member identification going on there.
So it's shortly after this that Columbus hears some strange banging noises, and so does Tallahassee, and they kind of meet up at the source of the noise, and they discover that Wichita has returned sans Little Rock. She's gathering supplies, guns, primarily guns and ammo, to go after her.
Because they encountered their own obnoxious interloper in the form of...
A hippie predictably named Berkeley.
Yeah.
The full boat, kind of scruffy, plays a guitar.
Patchouli oil.
Yeah, sings a lot of hippy-dippy kind of songs. Passes them off as his own, even though they're not deep cuts at all.
No.
Like a Rolling Stone is an example. So that's kind of where he's coming from. And once again, this time, Emma Stone is the one who is just infuriated with the newcomer. And eventually, it comes down to Abigail Breslin wants to go off with this dude because she wants to experience life as someone in their late teens ought to. She wants a boyfriend. She wants to be around people her own age. And that's why she left. And that's why she ends up leaving her sister. Is to go off with this guy. First, they're headed to Graceland and then other places, and we'll get to that.
So the four of them, meaning the three from the original crew who are still left, plus Madison, all hop in there's a string of car-related betrayals in this movie that I'm not going to recount completely accurately, I suspect. But they're forced to drive this little minivan that Woody Harrelson has just nothing but contempt for, and the four of them take off after Little Rock and Berkeley.
Yet another thing borrowed from the original. Woody Harrelson just destroys a minivan in Zombieland 1, and this time he just... There's a lot of angry muttering and kicking of the minivan. The first time they have to go back to the minivan, he talks about how samurai warriors, when they had utterly failed and disgraced themselves, had to commit seppuku. And he's saying that he wishes he had the implement necessary because of this fucking minivan.
Right.
And how they have to go back.
So the four of them run afoul of some zombies out on the road. They're trying to ditch the minivan and get into a more respectable set of wheels. And
yeah, big motorhome in this case.
And Madison trips an alarm and the zombies start flooding in. The last of which is a souped up kind of super zombie that they dub the T-800 after the Terminator.
Yes.
And it's just a bullet sponge. It can just
even in the head.
It can get it can get double tapped and keep right on trucking.
Eventually, they finally take him down. Woody Harrelson puts about 20 bullets in him and then smashes his skull with a boot.
And during the melee, Madison gets her Uggs nibbled on at one point.
Yes.
And it doesn't look like it, you know, Jesse Eisenberg comes to her rescue and she's like, OMG, you saved me. And she's then kind of like with a vaudeville crook, like yanked out of the movie for a little while, mercifully, because she appears to contract a bad case of zombieitis.
Yeah. And Columbus basically volunteers to give her the old Yeller treatment.
Yeah, they take her into the woods in a kind of weird, out-of-nowhere Miller's Crossing homage.
Right.
And knowing that it's a Miller's Crossing homage actually spoils the twist of what ends up happening.
True. Spoilers for Miller's Crossing.
Yeah, right. So I suspected that it was not actually a bad case of zombieitis, that there was something else going on. I don't know exactly what. And then once the Miller's Crossing illusion kind of washed over me, I knew like, oh, she's fine, obviously. And not only, you know, he's gonna spare her, he's gonna like fire up into the trees and just pretend that he killed her. Again, spoilers for a really great movie from
1990.
Damn near 30 years ago.
Jesus Christ. You know what that makes us? It makes us damn near 30,
yes. He does exactly that. We don't see it, so we're meant to not get the reference, I guess. I guess Ruben Fleischer thinks he's pulling a fast one on us.
I suppose so.
But so this is what my notes say. Did she just eat meat? Because one of her obnoxious characteristics is that she's very vegan And her literally her the first words out of her mouth are "Don't shoot, don't shoot. It's just it's fake fur," meaning the hood that she's wearing, the like parka that she's wearing to keep warm in the freezer is just fake fur. She thinks that she's about to be executed
by a rogue remaining PETA member or something.
Right. I mean, everything that she says is just some kind of variation on irritating millennial tropes.
Yes.
And so I thought that she had like accidentally, like she had like a bad meat allergy or something and had accidentally eaten meat or something, because she is acting like a zombie. She like can't talk. Her tongue is swelling up. She's like vomiting. She's got this pallid complexion. And so my notes say, did she just eat meat? Miller's Crossing? She for sure just ate meat. And I was actually wrong about, I was right about the substance, but not the particulars. And we'll get to that when we get to that.
Yeah. So they make it to Graceland, which is, again, where Little Rock and Berkeley were headed. But Graceland has been burned to the ground, which provokes cries of anguish from Woody Harrelson. They go down the road a little ways, and they find an Elvis-themed motel.
Tourist trap.
Yeah, kinda. Right, which is very Graceland in and of itself. So it's basically like they didn't miss out on anything.
And it's conspicuously well-maintained.
Yes.
Too, which for some reason doesn't raise any red flags.
Right, and in relatively short order, they spot Woody Harrelson's car out front, and so they expect to find Little Rock in there. And instead, they run into Nevada, played by Rosario Dawson, who is, I guess, the proprietress of sorts of this motel. And they have a bit of a standoff, which is eventually settled.
And she and Tallahassee are paired off.
Yes.
They bond over Elvis crap. And then, you know, being the last two
non-millennials
in the country, apparently, take each other to bed. The following morning, a monster truck wheels up outside and demolishes Woody Harrelson's rig.
Another cry of anguish.
Yeah, out steps Luke Wilson and the guy from, I think, is it T-Mobile? I know him from cell phones.
It's Verizon.
Verizon. Okay. See, this is my total lack of brand
Thomas
loyalty.
Thomas Middleditch, who some of you may know better from Silicon Valley.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, he's the lead from that, and he's been, I don't know, in a couple other things. Basically, they are very explicitly doppelgangers for Columbus and Tallahassee.
Which rubbed me the wrong way, because that gag is ripped off wholesale from Shaun of the Dead.
True.
But in this case, it just delivers fewer laughs, and it's like way more protracted. Like, they really lay on the horn, it's just like several uninterrupted minutes of Jesse Eisenberg and Silicon Valley comparing notes, you know, talking about their different rules.
Yeah. And being Thomas Middleditch, Flagstaff, he has commandments instead of rules, and they discuss their tiny variations. Meanwhile, Albuquerque, Luke Wilson, and Tallahassee kind of
get into a pissing match to end all pissing matches.
Yes, because apparently Albuquerque has also been involved with Nevada.
Yeah.
And so they get kind of territorial, and she doesn't take too kindly to that for obvious reasons.
I gotta say, Jesse Eisenberg and T-Mobile are like, it's eerie. Like, they play off of each other really well, even if the like gag didn't work for me. They are
weirdly similar.
Yeah, no, I mean they nail the characterization. I mean, it is like a Funhouse mirror kind of thing. I don't know why you would cast Luke Wilson as the Woody Harrelson analog. He's just, he is doing a passable Woody Harrelson impression. He's just not, he wouldn't have been my go-to, you know.
Right. There definitely could have been dumber choices, but yeah, it's not the first one that I think I would have gone for either.
And in any case, these characters don't stick around for very long. A couple T-800s descend upon the
monster truck.
Yeah, upon the monster truck, and the two new arrivals volunteer to fend them off, and both get bitten. Try to hide it in classic zombie movie fashion, and then become T-800s themselves.
Yes, and eventually are dispatched. I can get more into this after the break, but it just seems like whenever this movie introduces new characters, it decides, wait a minute, no, we don't want new characters. Now we have to get rid of them.
Right. They stick around basically just long enough to confirm that the T-800s are out in force, like out on the plains, that it's more than just a few isolated incidents, that it's a whole new phenomenon. And they call them Bolts, as in Usain, which I don't know why you wouldn't just call them Usains. That sounds a lot cooler. Calling them Bolts just makes me think of that like Miley Cyrus stunt dog movie.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't... Usain Bolt, before they actually said his name, I just figured they called him Bolts because they, you know, bolt. They're fast. But anyway, so Nevada informs Columbus and Tallahassee and Wichita that Berkeley and Little Rock went off to this commune called Babylon, which is apparently not named after the great ancient city of Babylon, but some fucking song or other. I was not familiar with that reference.
Oh, the David Gray song? Yeah, no, I'm only dimly aware of what that was all about.
Yeah, but...
Babylon is basically like the setting from Land of the Dead if it was also a Grateful Dead concert.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it reminded me, it made me think like, I should rewatch Land of the Dead. Dennis Hopper was a lot of fun in that.
He was. Zombies, man. They creep me out. So, yeah, cuts to Berkeley and Little Rock getting to Babylon, and she has to hand over her gun to get melted down for a peace sign pendant, and the rest of the crew heads off. Wichita and Columbus try to get Tallahassee to bring Nevada with them, and that's not his style, nor hers, apparently.
Right.
So they head off for Babylon.
And then, en route, they encounter Madison, alive and well, and not a zombie.
And turns out that she ate some trail mix, which she did not expect to have nuts in it.
Yeah, because she has a hitherto unmentioned nut allergy, which or did it come up at some point?
I don't think so.
Yeah, so I think, I don't know. I feel like that's a pretty basic failure of planting and payoff. And it's not like a deal breaker. I just think that when her defining characteristic is that she's like an irritating vegan, I would have expected that to be the...
Also, I feel like nut allergies are just another like massive millennial phenomenon.
It seems
like they've become omnipresent almost.
Uh huh.
So that would have, yeah, fit into the very tropey nature of her character all the more.
Sure.
Anyhow, they get her back in their car and then they head off to Babylon where they are forced to hand over their guns also. Yeah.
This is the movie's last big laugh, at least for me, is when Woody Harrelson throws absentmindedly almost tosses a grenade into the minivan without consulting anyone.
Yeah, right.
Needless
no,
to say.
He's just like this minivan dies here and now. Rule 32, gotta enjoy the little things.
It was that and the seppuku rant and the Taft portrait that like really...
You'll notice that there's a common thread here, namely that it's all Woody Harrelson gags.
Right.
Because he's the real MVP.
For sure. So they reluctantly get their guns melted down in the hippie forge and then start trying to acclimate to life in this commune. Little Rock is not overjoyed to see them. She thinks that they're not going to fit in, you know, quite rightly.
Yeah.
So Woody Harrelson makes his peace with the fact that she's safe and starts doing his lone wolf thing. He rides off into the sunset, basically, in a pickup truck.
Yeah.
Natch.
And on the way out of Dodge, he encounters a swarm of T-800s charging in the direction of Babylon, where they're setting off a bunch of fucking fireworks for some reason. And so... He immediately pulls an aggressive Yui and heads back to help them out. And now they have to figure out how to dispose of all of these, not just zombies, but very dangerous, like 28 days later kind of zombies.
Right. The stage is now set for sort of like a hippy-dippy Helm's Deep, where they're severely outnumbered and also have no conventional weapons or firearms, at least, or really weapons of any kind.
Right. They do use a tank of biodiesel fuel to set a trap, which is remarkably ineffectual in the end.
Right. And also a missed opportunity because it might just be because I liked The Crow in my formative years, but I feel like if you're going to pour down a bunch of burning gasoline, you ought to at least make it a fun shape. You know, like, I don't know. I mean, the what they do in the movie is practical enough, but I feel like in a movie like Zombieland, a little bit more theatricality might be in order. They could have at least made it like a big peace symbol or a pot leaf or something.
Yeah, well, missed opportunities. Anyway, after the biodiesel tank is woefully insufficient, the crew of four gets trapped in this, I don't know, elevated sort of pavilion, kind of reminiscent of Woody Harrelson at the end of Zombieland.
Yeah, his one, last stand.
Which proves obviously not to be his last stand, but it looks like it for a time. And just as they're all sort of hugging each other and preparing for the end, in rolls Nevada driving Albuquerque's monster truck and proceeds to beat wholesale ass on those zombies. Just crushing all of them, pulling tricks. She picks the crew up and they all get in the monster truck, which eventually rolls over, which they did prepare for because Jesse Eisenberg bitches about rollover risk.
Right. There's a bunch of stuff during the climax that was prepared for. So just because I harped on about the nut allergy problem that may not be a problem for anyone else, there is actually some more competent planting and payoff happening here. One that we didn't touch on is when they're in the abandoned mall right before they run across Madison the first time. Woody Harrelson has this little soliloquy about how he's part Iroquois or something.
Blackfoot.
Yeah. And he talks about this legend of the great buffalo jump.
The Blackfoot, when they hunted buffalo, they would just kind of drive them off a cliff in order to kill them.
Right.
And so he goes on this long rant, and eventually Jesse Eisenberg just drives away on his Segway while Woody Harrelson is looking away.
Yeah, it's mostly a kind of comedic non-starter for me, although it was pretty funny hearing Woody Harrelson call someone else a pale face. That kind of tickled me, but more on that after the break. So they end up doing a riff on that where Woody Harrelson does sort of a running of the bulls stunt with leading a bunch of zombies up the stairs all the way to the top of this Land of the Dead-esque skyscraper, and then he runs off the roof and they all follow suit. They're all sort of being funneled.
Yeah, because they've set up a gauntlet of like sheet metal kind of funneling them. Yeah, again.
Yeah, it's kind of like classic 60s counterculture protest imagery, it looks like. Yeah. But they're like on the other side of the riot shields, which was sort of clever, I guess. And anyway, Woody Harrelson grabs onto a dangling length of chain or a hook or something. And
yeah, it's like a crane hook.
Yeah, and manages to not plunge to his death. He very nearly does because a couple stragglers grab onto him. But then another instance of competent planting and payoff. Abigail Breslin shoots one of the zombies nipping at his ankles in the head with her Elvis gun, which she smuggled into the commune.
And, I mean, that's basically the end of the movie. Tallahassee, again, is paired off with Nevada, who we find out, once she's willing to let her guard down a little further, is Reno. So they're paired off, and Emma Stone belatedly accepts Jesse Eisenberg's marriage proposal. Madison, who had initially found the ring in a drawer and had taken it for herself, sort of forks it over. Abigail Breslin has kind of tossed Berkeley aside because he's a poser douche. And so, meanwhile, he's kind of eyeballing Madison, vice versa, and she gives them permission to make out.
Yeah, they deserve each other, and they deserve a different movie. You know, they deserve to be put on an ice floe and pushed out to sea, actually.
And then, the original four plus Reno drive off in Elvis's pink Cadillac off into the sunset. This is the last time we see them.
Yes.
But this is not the end of the movie, because in reference to the original film, where, fucking spoiler alert, Bill Murray shows up as himself and then he's playing a prank on Jesse Eisenberg, pretending to be a zombie, and Jesse Eisenberg shoots him. And then this has apparently become like an urban legend. It's called Murraying. Killing when someone you mistake for a zombie.
Right. That sounds like there's probably a TV Tropes page with that name. Like, that sounds like something that the screenwriters, like, that sounds like something that the original Zombieland might have actually introduced into the lexicon in the real world, at least if you move in movie dweeb circles. I wouldn't be surprised at all if that was something that zombie nuts actually said to one another.
Yeah. But anyway, so Jesse Eisenberg pops in with his last bit of narration, offering an apology for murdering Bill Murray. And by way of apology, we are offered a flashback to a press junket for Garfield 3.
Flabby Tabby, I think.
Yes, that sounds right. The most noteworthy portion of which is that, I guess, having a hairball is something of a catchphrase. So all the reporters, like Al Roker among them, are trying to get Bill Murray to hack up a hairball on camera.
It goes on for kind of an incredibly long time, and it really feels like a gag that Bill Murray himself came up with, because it's so much weirder than anything else in the movie. He just sits there going like, making these grotesque, Gollum-y kind of noises, and Al Roker joins in, and then seamlessly transitions into zombiehood, because the gagging gives way to, you know,
vomiting and growling.
Yeah.
And then we have a sequence of Bill Murray killing some zombies, saving some people at this press junket.
He's actually pretty inept at saving people, actually. It looks like he's mostly just enjoying himself.
Right. And yeah, so that's that. And then post-credits, because this was kind of a mid-credits scene, post-credits, it's just more of him hairballing.
Yeah, just right.
So anyway, that was Zombieland Double Tap. We're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with our thoughts in just a moment.
Oh, God.
Hey, Possum Age.
Sorry, just you in that chair.
I think I would have made a damn fine president.
You would have brought a real dignity to the office.
You're welcome, America.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break, to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at ShockDoctorsPod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
No! That's my ride!
Oh, my apologies, little Elvis.
Okay, is it me, or does he kind of remind you of...
I don't like you. At all.
I think you double parked. Or more perpendicular parked. Hope we don't get a ticket.
What is going on here?
What?
Hello, everyone.
Am I hallucinating?
And we're back. So, I guess the first thing I want to open with, and this might be stealing Matt's thunder a little bit, although I'm sure he'll have plenty to add, maybe the biggest issue that I had with this movie, and maybe this will make me out to be an obnoxious SJW millennial, but fuck it, whatever. Madison, the character.
But Madison. Berkeley. Let's not split hairs.
But I'm okay with hating hippies.
As am I. I just thought that both of those caricatures were just chronically unfunny in a way that I couldn't, like, get over. It was so broad that I didn't even feel, like, targeted. Like, if it was, like, scalpel sharp satire, then I might have had a classic millennial, I came here to have a good time and I'm just feeling very attacked right now kind of moment. But it didn't, it was just so... It was such a fucking haymaker. It's like the movie was blindfolded and just flailing in the general direction of some very played out, tired old straw man.
Yeah. And now's the point at which we can safely point out that Jesse Eisenberg and Emma Stone both also qualify as millennials. They fit into the generational cross section. But the issue, particularly with Madison, because it's always, if not funny, at least easy and not really harmful to make fun of just obnoxious poser douchebags.
Sure.
But,
I mean, yeah, the guy's a plagiarist. Fuck him. You know,
yeah, exactly. But, there you go. But Madison, first of all, played by Zoe Deutsch, who we hadn't named up to this point, She's, in my experience, fairly talented comic actress. She played the female lead in Everybody Wants Some. She was good in that. I've seen her in some other stuff where she's generally been good, even when the movie has not been so good. And here,
it's just
all Ruben Fleischer gives her to do is just, it's like the Valley Girl thing from 30 fucking years ago.
Yeah, it's just a vapid bimbo. It's the most thankless role ever committed to paper, much less screen.
And I was hoping that they were going to eventually, not that this would have been like groundbreaking or even particularly interesting, but at least it would have been better. I was hoping they were laying the groundwork for her somewhere in the third act, maybe, to be like, actually, I'm not an idiot. This is, you know, a defense mechanism. It's a tool. Something like that.
Which,
you know,
would have just been a rehash of the, like, Emma Stone, Abigail Breslin zombie bite pantomime from the first movie.
Sure.
But it would have, you know,
been better.
Better than nothing. And it is just nothing. I mean, I thought that they were going to do almost like, and I don't know that this would have been funny, but it at least would have indicated that her character was more than just paper thin. I thought that the joke was going to end up being that she was some kind of idiot savant. Because she has survived alone in a zombie apocalypse for a decade.
There's also a scene where
you don't do that by mistake.
There's also a scene where she comes up with Uber, basically.
Yeah,
in the back seat, and everyone's response is obviously, this was a little funny, it was obviously just like, oh, but you get in a car with a stranger and they'll murder you.
Yeah, right. It would never work. Yeah.
Which we've all forgotten in the age of ride sharing.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But, yeah, so
fucking gig economy.
Yeah, you think if she's not going to be like conventionally intelligent in that kind of quote unquote surprise way, at least as Matt says, maybe in the idiot savant sense, but no, the Uber thing is really the only thing that points in that direction. That, and again, she's managed to survive for all this time.
Right. I mean, Jesus Christ, even like Newt from Aliens had more going for her, and she was just like a hapless child who basically does the same thing, just like survives improbably despite not appearing to have any survival skills whatsoever, you know?
But
I mean, but
Newt is also a child.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Madison is
not
a grown woman.
Yeah, right.
Not a particularly old one, but an adult.
Although she would have been a child in 2009, right? Or no?
The actress would have been, I think. So presumably the character, too.
Yeah, right. And that's not touched on at all. Like, it would have been funny if she had, like, quasi-feral characteristics that just emerged every once in a while underneath all of the OMG soy random. She says soy instead of so.
Yep, it's true. She does.
More than zero.
It's a lot.
Which was too many. And yeah, no, I mean, and Berkeley pissed me off too. I mean, Berkeley and Madison were both just an insurmountable problem for me, and neither of them ever made me laugh. There's a bit in my notes where I wrote down JFC, he's literally singing Kumbaya. I mean, it's just so,
and saying Buddha instead of my Lord.
Just, did he? I didn't catch that.
Yeah,
I mean, no. It's the lowest of the low hanging fruit. I mean, it's so tired. It made me very tired. I'm tired right now.
Yeah, and again, this movie introduces new characters, and then it decides it doesn't know what the fuck to do with them. It doesn't want them there, and so it gets rid of them.
It doesn't really know what to do with some of the old characters either. I think that Abigail Breslin growing up kind of threw a monkey wrench into the sister dynamic from the first movie.
True.
And I didn't really know how to resolve that because she's gone for 80% of it. Yeah, and I thought that it would cut away to her more often because she is that's this movie's end game. You know, she's the carrot on the end of the stick that gets these characters going on their journey, but she is just sort of, and I was relieved that it didn't cut back to her very often because I found Berkeley so insufferable.
Right.
But I mean, the movie also doesn't really give her much of anything to do.
No.
Which makes some of the, like, we're a family stuff at the end ring a little bit hollow when they're all hugging it out when right before Rosario Dawson shows up to save the day. I just sort of didn't buy it.
Yeah.
Granted, I did only just watch the first movie yesterday. I don't have 10 years worth of nostalgia sunk into this property. But yeah, even still, I didn't really... Whatever. It's not the kind of movie that actually wants to tug at your heartstrings. It just kind of has to pretend that it wants to.
Yeah.
Because that's what is supposed to happen in the third act.
Yeah. But, I mean, they bring in Albuquerque and Flagstaff, and they, I guess, achieve their gag, sort of.
And then some. And they kind of run it into the ground.
And then dispose of them. That's what I thought they might do with Madison, because like you, Matt, I saw the Miller's Crossing vibes going on,
yeah,
but I also legitimately thought it could be an accident.
Oh my god, I don't want to die in the woods like a dumb animal. Gross.
Yeah, but I legitimately thought, like, maybe Ruben Fleischer doesn't realize what he's doing.
Yeah.
Because he directed Gangster Squad. and Venom.
So anyone who's directed Gangster Squad cannot have seen Miller's Crossing. It's a known fact. I mean, you can... I don't know.
John Polito is in Gangster Squad for like 2 minutes.
Maybe he lent him the DVD. I don't know. I guess it's been a while since 2013, too.
Oh, my God.
Is that when that movie came out? Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I didn't want to think about it, but yeah. But yeah, so I thought that's basically what they were doing with Madison. And they still kind of do it halfway because they get her out of the way for 40% of the movie there in the middle because they don't know what the fuck to do with her.
Right.
And yeah, they don't know what the fuck to do with Berkeley, which is for the best because they get him off screen pretty quickly.
Yeah, the thing to do with Berkeley is to immerse him feet first in the gun forge where they're melting down all of the firearms that they confiscate.
Yeah, and he starts making noises like Christopher Lloyd at the end of Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, and then one final line about how like they're really harshing his mellow or some other fucking phoned in
bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, I understand on the one hand, you had an entire movie about these four characters already, and it would have been tricky to make another entire movie just about these four characters all just hanging out together, because there's no longer an arc of them, like, meeting and getting close and all that. So you kind of have to do something else, but if you're going to do that, I do better. Like, make better ones.
Yeah, I mean, there's any number of ways to introduce friction. I mean, it's... I mean, really, friction is ever present. I mean, they start squabbling almost immediately over who gets to sit behind the desk in the Oval Office. So there's any number of reasons that these characters could have a falling out or decide to go their separate ways. I mean, that does indeed happen. And it has Woody Harrelson, as I said, rides off into the sunset at one point, and it has nothing to do with Berkeley or Madison or any of the other uninvited guests that this movie is cluttered with.
Right.
It's just him doing his thing, being true to his character.
Right. Something that I thought they were doing more with this movie that they didn't in the original, and it ended up being less true than I expected, was in the original film, nobody dies.
Yeah.
Which is nuts for a zombie movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the credits, I was struck by this when we watched it.
Okay,
the other day.
I'm sorry. Bill Murray dies.
Yes.
But that's a gag.
He gets murried. I was struck by this when we watched that movie yesterday. Bill Murray is like fifth credited. He's
right.
And not just because he's a celebrity. He is like the fifth most important character.
Yeah.
It's like, and then right underneath him is the clown zombie. And that's it. It is really just the four of them.
Yeah.
So yeah, if any of them died, it would be a huge bummer and kind of end the movie on a downer. And it's not that kind of movie.
Oh, well, I guess Amber Heard.
Yes.
Is in
I was
the
about to
the
say
a
apartment number, whatever.
406.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
she's above Clown Zombie, but I think beneath Bill Murray.
Which stands to reason.
Sure.
So, okay, she dies. But really, like, nobody dies. Even in every zombie movie, like, even primarily zom-coms, obviously this is most true in Shaun of the Dead and the zom-com subgenre, people die. But even, like, less developed zombie comedies have people die, and it's supposed to be at least like punching in the direction of being emotional. And
or if they introduce a really hateful, irredeemably aggravating character, the best reason to do that is to watch them get pulled apart.
Right.
And even that doesn't happen here. I mean, it's a weirdly mean-spirited movie that's also like basically good-natured because it just doesn't want to kill anybody,
right?
Even like, even characters that we don't care about. So it's kind of, it's like mean and toothless at the same time, which right. kind of bothered me.
So I figured that this movie was going to be different from the original in that people were dying, like Madison turns zombie and has to get Old Yellered, except she doesn't. She right. has a nut allergy.
Or John Turturro'd in this case.
Right. And, I mean, I guess they kill off Flagstaff in Albuquerque.
Right. But they were redundant anyway. They were, like, Xerox they were, copies. Like, of...
They were, their defining characteristic was that they were redundant.
Yeah.
And they kill them off much quicker than Madison looked like she was being killed off.
Right.
She had been around a lot longer. They don't even kill Berkeley. No. God damn it.
Or the other guy in the commune who keeps...
bringing up group sex.
Yeah, hint, hint, nudge, nudging about how he wants to have an orgy.
Yeah. And they're hippies who don't like to use weapons and kill zombies. Like, there's a whole bit when Wichita is talking about how they met Berkeley and how he doesn't carry weapons. His whole thing is conflict avoidance. And this makes... Woody Harrelson furious. And prime candidate Berkeley for just getting dead.
Yeah.
During, if nowhere else, then during the climax. Nope.
No.
He's just, they got to keep him around so he can make out with Madison and she doesn't have to be alone after
yeah,
being
right. so that
spurned in favor of Wichita.
Everyone gets a happy ending, even the characters that don't deserve one.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. On the subject of Woody Harrelson flipping 10 shits about Berkeley being a pacifist, there's a bit in that scene where, if I heard him correctly, he's, like, raging and, like, throwing a bunch of stuff over in some, like, gymnasium in the White House.
Well, it's like a storage room
right.
that has... Among other things, like basketballs in it.
Yeah,
like
and he knocks over a rack of basketballs and I think exclaims, fucking basketballs!
he definitely
which
does.
Which is definitely an ad-lib and sort of a funny one, although I think that this movie... I don't know, I think that moment sort of irked me as kind of... It tickled me at the same time because it's funny for him to take his anger out on the basketballs when they did nothing wrong. They are blameless in this affair. But Woody Harrelson is just seeing red and attacking the nearest inanimate object. But, like, the take sounds a little muddy. You know, it's definitely something that they only got one take of. I kind of expected, actually, the obligatory post-credits sequence to just be an extended take of Woody Harrelson pushing stuff over. And,
right.
you know, groaning and grumbling and carrying on. But it just... It seems to me that him saying fucking basketballs and, like, me just barely being able to hear it shouldn't be one of the funnier beats in the movie. I just think that a lot of the banter is a little bit, not completely brain dead, but a little first draft. And that becomes more true near the end of the movie. I think, like, the writing craps out first and then... I don't know, like some of the riffing about like is that or isn't it a Phil Collins song that just felt like placeholder banter. I don't know if you're on the same page there, but it just either the movie just lost me and then my mind started wandering and therefore the dialogue got worse subjectively or
right.
they actually didn't polish the last like 15 minutes of this movie as much as maybe they could have 15, 20.
Yeah, I mean...
Put it this way. There's two moments in this movie where Woody Harrelson says, this is going to be a long drive.
Yep.
And I'm like, I only needed to hear that once. It was kind of a perfunctory line the first time. It's a very, like, are we there yet kind of phoned-in road trip joke already before it gets repeated. I don't know. There was a little bit too much of that, and the first movie was not, like, a masterpiece, but largely, it didn't, like, spin its wheels that much.
No. For one thing, I think this movie's, like, 10 or 15 minutes longer.
Okay.
And maybe it suffers for that. Maybe they should have just aimed to be as long as the first one, and maybe they'd have more content. I didn't really notice it during the movie, but I think you're right. I think the first act... The dialogue is tighter.
A little snappier. Feels like a little bit more care was put into it.
Yeah. It's almost like the arrival of these lazily written characters sparked lazy dialogue.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, the first act is before they meet any of these new people. And mm-hmm. it's basically like, let's get the band back together from the first movie 10 years later. And it's a little worse for the wear, but it's clipping along. And then, yeah, it just kind of goes.
Yeah, and I think that there's... So every once in a while, the movie, like the Uber thing is maybe the prime example of this. And to a lesser extent, the notion of Woody Harrelson being the president. Emma Stone makes some crack about how he would have brought a lot of dignity to the office.
Yeah.
That feels like a joke that people would make when their last president was Obama for 1 year. Like, you know, like the office has been sullied of late, and the idea of President Tallahassee is maybe not as outlandish as it once was. So I think that was kind of, I mean, for the amount of time that they spend in the White House, the jokes don't get political per se, unless you count jokes at the expense of Taft's weight, which, you know,
no,
is a pretty safe target, I would say. But, you know, there's like that. They don't know that Donald Trump was ever the president. They don't know that Uber was ever a thing. Occasionally, there's amusing gags to do with the fact that for them, pop culture ended in 2009. But they don't do enough with that.
And there's also a kind of dumbass, lampshady line about that, courtesy of Albuquerque.
Yes.
When...
One of the many times that Woody Harrelson quips, time to nut up or shut up.
Yeah, so Woody Harrelson says that, and then Luke Wilson says something along the lines of, that line is pretty 2009, and then Emma Stone laughs, and it's almost like she got hit with a cattle prod to laugh. Like, we need the laugh here. We need people to know that this is the laugh track. Yeah. Fucking laugh.
They could have used a couple cattle prods in the theater, I think. Maybe some like 4D D-box bullshit where they just zap you like a lab rat periodically. Yeah, no, I mean, it's a fucking odd line because they should all be in arrested development, pop culturally speaking. Like, there are no 2010, 2011, 2012 lines or shouldn't be. They should all be talking like that. And also, Madison should be a little more traumatized from having lived in a fridge for a whole ass decade.
And I don't think people were saying things like soy random in 2009. I'm pretty sure that's right. This decade.
Yeah. So it's all very scattershot. And that sort of was a source of consternation for me. And it's not the sort of thing that you get hung up on unless the movie is not entertaining you as much as it could be or should be.
Right.
It's the sort of world building fail that only really matters if the movie, you know, if the movie is firing on all cylinders, stuff like that just is like water off a duck's back. You don't even notice it.
Yeah.
But here I did. And it doesn't stop there. You start tripping over other things like, wow, Bill Murray looks really old for this supposedly being a flashback. And this is a world where Uber doesn't exist, but Garfield 3 does.
Right.
So, I mean, that whole bit of Bill Murray K&A right before the credits resume is mostly good fun. I mean, I think him trying to hork up a hairball for Al Roker is easily the funniest part. Him like cracking plates over zombies' heads. You know, it looks like he's enjoying himself, and it's good to see Bill Murray enjoying himself. It looks like he's having more fun here than in Dead Don't Die.
Yeah.
But I don't know. The final line of the movie is, I hate Mondays, which is pretty funny. But it would have been funnier if it had been deployed differently, because he seems to be enjoying himself when he says it. And it's not the kind of line that you can say with a smile. Like, if Al Roker had ripped someone's jugular out right in front of Bill Murray, and then Bill Murray had said, I hate Mondays, and then it had cut to black, that would have been like a slam dunk.
Yes. You're not wrong about that.
Actually, the thing about this movie that feels the most like a 2009 throwback is that it's the most classically Eisenbergian performance I've seen in a really long time. If nothing else, this movie does just wash that Lex Luthor right out of your hair. You know, it kind of rolls back the clock to like a pre-Social Network time.
It's an Adventureland
performance. Oh yeah, for sure. It's Adventureland like down to its DNA. That was good fun. The movie is weirdly light on zombie slaying, I think, for like long swaths of it. There's a couple standout set pieces. Obviously, the climax is one. There's another bit. It's when Albuquerque and T-Mobile turn T-800, and the whole brawl with them in the tourist trap Elvis Hotel plays out in what appears to be one long, unbroken take. And this is sort of, I don't know, it's weird. There's something about Ruben Fleischer's work, and I've only seen the two Zombielands and Gangster Squad. I've not seen Venom or any of his other work. But
fortunate.
Yeah, him.
In the case of Venom.
He has a way of doing these occasional directorial flourishes that feel kind of, for some reason, whenever he does something like that, you know, like it's an action scene and we're going to do it in one unbroken take. I don't think Children of Men. It always just feels very video gamey. For some reason, and I don't know why that is. Like, this was especially true of Gangster Squad. Gangster Squad felt like a movie adapted from a game, adapted from a movie. It felt
Godfather like the game, the movie.
The movie. Yeah, exactly. it feels terribly diluted for some reason. And I don't know why that is. It might be that he occasionally just flips the auteur switch. Like, basically anytime he does like gratuitous slow-mo or an action scene that plays out all in one take or something like that. But otherwise, his movies have nothing to distinguish them. It might be that, like, Jekyll Hyde thing that I'm getting stuck on, because he really, again, haven't seen Venom, his box office shattering magnum opus.
Oof.
Like a turd in the wind. But
as I've often said, that line is funny. It's the only good thing about that movie.
But I just saw an interview with him the other day where he was grousing about the fact that critics didn't like Venom more. I don't know. It's Ruben Fleischer just kind of is stuck in my craw, and I don't know quite what to make of him.
I think that's fair.
But it's just so binary. I mean, his movies are all just like shot, reverse shot, dialogue heavy, kind of pedestrian sitcom adjacent sort of stuff. And then all of a sudden he like starts using storyboards and like moving the camera in ways that ought to be interesting but aren't for some reason. And I don't know. I mean, Zombieland is far and away his best movie, the first one. I mean, and even there, I didn't feel like he was bringing that much to the table.
Yeah, no, I think the original Zombieland is much more about the script and the actors than the direction.
On the subject of the original Zombieland, there's a scene in it that is quite funny, but I also found a little bit troubling. It's actually my favorite moment in the original Zombieland, again, a movie that I just watched yesterday, so it's mostly fresh in my mind, is when Jesse Eisenberg sprays the back of Woody Harrelson's neck with a little bit of perfume, and Woody Harrelson actually scared me. He like turned around and shot a look that was like True Detective tier. He was like ready to like unzip Jesse Eisenberg down the middle, just like grab either arm and like pull him in half. The guy was ready to throw down, and it's really funny to like see him get that pissed about. It feels way more authentic than any of the diatribes he goes on in this movie. Like, it almost looks like an unscripted thing where Woody Harrelson's toxic masculinity was triggered and he was about to, like, throw Jesse Eisenberg into the catering table or something, you know? Like, it's really good stuff.
Instead, he only got 45% power.
Yeah, right. Which is also a good line. But that whole scene transpires in like a kitschy Native American gift shop with like wooden Indian chiefs and stuff and beads and peace pipes and feather headdresses and things like that. And these four characters just lay waste to it. And it felt like if it was anyone but Ruben Fleischer, I would have thought that like it was some kind of weird allegorical thing where it doesn't help that one of the characters is literally named Columbus. So maybe that's why I was thinking along these lines. But like Zombieland is a fun movie and I didn't get stuck in the mud about that. But then in this movie, when Woody Harrelson started talking about how he was 1/8 Blackfoot or whatever Elizabeth Warren bullshit and called Jesse Eisenberg a pale face, you know, it's just, I don't know. These movies, they occasionally feel a little retrograde in a way that's difficult to pin down. And I probably sound like a full-blown Berkeley Madison on this score. But like the tired jokes about hippies that are like worse versions of things that South Park did like 15 years ago. So in the first Zombieland, and this movie largely gets away from it, thankfully, credit where it's due, I suppose. It's been 10 years. In the first Zombieland, Jesse Eisenberg is a little bit of a red-pilled shitlord. There's like a little bit of narration where he talks about how Emma Stone isn't, you know,
your typical stuck-up bitch.
Yeah, right. And, you know,
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Hello, 2009. And
not so nice to see you.
And there's not that much of that in this movie, but I think that you kind of just still get the vibe that the movie is written by bad nerds. And they play their hand in the bit where Woody Harrelson and Rosario Dawson are bonding over Elvis memorabilia and their own personal history with the King's music. And Woody Harrelson talks about singing Hound Dog in the school library in high school and bringing the house down, and how this hot, popular chick who never gave him the time of day gave him a kiss on the cheek. And I'm like, okay. Tallahassee was not a dork in high school.
Absolutely
I'm
not.
Sorry.
No.
That is not canon.
Rejected.
He didn't have to be a linebacker or, you know, like a jock or whatever, if we're still using that word. But he wasn't a geek. He wasn't an unpopular misfit. I mean, you know, it just, I'm sorry. I don't buy it. And you can just tell that there's a little bit of, I don't know, screenwriter projection happening there, that and it's more of a feature of the first Zombieland. It mars the first Zombieland a lot more than this one, but it's still present. And because this movie is not as entertaining as the first Zombieland, it almost bothered me more this time around, even though there was less of it.
Sure.
I don't know, I just ran the gamut from like a funny facsimile of Native American genocide to just like not believing that Woody Harrelson was ever incapable of getting pretty girls to smooch him. So I don't know if that was at all coherent, but there's just sort of this weird slippery thing about these movies where it seems like there's just a little bit of toxic something or other bleeding into them that I don't quite know how to put into words.
Yeah. I mean, I opened this segment by harping on about Madison and how she's just a dumb girl.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, that's case in point.
That's more than a leak. That's an Exxon Valdez. That's an oil disaster.
That's a major ecological setback, right? Yeah. I mean, that's one way in which this movie winds back the clock in a not so enjoyable way.
Back further than 2009, I feel.
Oh yeah, pre Adventureland. This is some like Revenge of the Nerds bullshit.
Yeah. Speaking of which, if you've never seen Revenge of the Nerds, don't watch it.
I haven't seen it, actually.
I'm telling you now, don't. It's because you can't get through it.
No,
it's,
sure.
It's rough.
Well, I had a hard time with Monster Squad, too, when we watched it, where the hot chick gets blackmailed with nude photos that were taken without her knowledge. That was true. You know, it was just...
Well, if you had trouble with Monster Squad, Revenge of the Nerds would be worse.
Right. Blackmailed by the protagonist, I hasten to add. By Dracula. Or, you know, the villains. That's
just imagining Dracula blackmailing someone with nudes.
Yeah, no, Dracula's really into the fappening. That's, you know, that's his whole deal these days. I don't know if you knew that.
Well, I think we've probably covered all the bases. What do you think?
I would say so. Yeah, I think we've strayed pretty far from the point here. Yeah, no, it's all I got.
Yeah, you know, overall, we've certainly had worse times at the movies, but
see it at 10 a.m. like we did. It's a matinee movie.
Yeah,
through and through.
A Netflix.
Oh, even better. Yeah,
a year from now or whatever, or Hulu or whichever fucking one it ends up on. Anyway. This has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Grand Blank.
I'm Oakland.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Zombieland Double Tap Official Trailer HD, uploaded by Sony Pictures Entertainment. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, November 3rd, and we'll be discussing Robert Eggers' long-awaited sophomore feature, The Lighthouse. See you then.